Let's invite our two commentators to come up. Which one, Christian, you want to start? Why don't you come up to the podium? And we'll let Christian. It doesn't matter.
I'm going to go back and join the
members here. We may run a little bit over, so 10, 15 minutes maybe.
10, 15 minutes, Jesus.
As much as you can.
Yeah. I don't think I will bother with tedious remarks about this gap stuff. I played dog, I lifted my leg, you know, you can sniff it out, read it for yourself. I'm just lucky that I had the chance to put it out to the public, because I had written this stuff in 2004 for a meeting in San Diego.
Yeah.
And then one shiny, bright morning, I was at the stupid convention. I think it was my last American Sociological Convention meeting that I attended. Then I saw they butchered my commentary, right? I was going really electric. I thought this Cornelius guy, he should be nailed, teared and feathered. Well, I've never met him since. Anyway, now I had the chance to put it straight. What I find a little bit more interesting is to talk about these types of country you have. And already François Héran made a rather more interesting suggestion with the help of these OECD typology, which I have not seen. And in that typology, there is a lot of emphasis on low versus high-skilled migration policies, and whether countries have rather a higher low-skilled than a high-skilled intake. That is already much more interesting than this nation of immigrants, country of immigrants, latecomers. Particularly stupid is the latecomer category. You know, it packs these two East Asian countries together with Spain and Italy. That is absolutely nonsensical. Most migrants actually in Spain and Italy are low-skilled, and they are in a way wanted and needed, filling the needs of the informal economy. If you meet a Korean official talking about low-skilled people, you feel they're talking about dogs, but not human beings. We don't want low-skilled people. I was at a meeting, actually, invited together with Dimitrios Papadimitriou, and I remember them at a dinner in a nice pagoda section of Seoul, and Mr. Papa, because I can of course not pronounce Papadimitriou, Mr. Papa, how do we manage to get high-skilled immigrants? We don't want these stupid low-skilled. No, we don't want them. No, out. So you get a sense in East Asia, these guys don't have a Christian tradition. They just don't think they're human beings endowed with their equal dignity. No, there's one category of person, then there's another category of person, but they don't share humanity. So now to put them together into this residual late-coming category is nonsensical. Now, the point is, I'm trying to make in my second half of these remarks, there is no immigration policy in the singular. We have to abandon that idea that there is one immigration policy in the singular. And somehow the volume plays with that. There's a singular. And it even gets it wrong if it says it's control. Because control is, in a way, a niggardly minded attempt to restrict, to keep out. But that misses actually a real novelty in Europe, that migration policies after the guest worker, after the post-colonial era, are into trying to solicit high-skilled people. So it is a completely different mindset. It's not a control mindset. It's actually to roll out red carpets. And the gap here is not that there are too many of them and we were not efficient enough in keeping out the unwanted masses. But here, the gap actually is we didn't get enough of them. And that was the experience that Schröder and Joschka Fischer had in the year 2000 when they introduced this totally mislabeled green card scheme that was a quota of 20,000 that could never be filled because the Germans were still running around with their old control mindset and thought, we give only 4 or 5 years and then not renewable. There was actually no family rights provided in that earliest scheme. So there was the control mindset still at play that prevented them from achieving their policy goals. I'm just doing a book which, we are all into populism these days, even me. the working title of that book is no longer with populism. The editors and the reviewers, the anonymous reviewers, talked me out of it. Now the working title is The Neo-Nationalism-Neoliberalism Nexus, Immigration and Citizenship in Changing Tides. And I have one immigration chapter, a big one, totally went out of limits. And I structure that chapter. It's all in the title, Courting the Top, Fending Off the Bottom. Immigration. That is the structure of immigration policy in the neoliberal era. All countries, you know, from Denmark to Canada to Singapore, try to solicit high-skilled people. All of them try to fend off the bottom, that is, to control, using the title of this volume, people who are unwanted. And of course, the antonym to high-skilled is low-skilled. But the low-skilled category is a tricky one, because all countries, of course, or most countries, have programs for low-skilled migrants, which already look completely in the control setting, no family unification rights, little possibility to acquire permanent residence, even though Western countries in the end cannot do it. They cannot play the Gulf game with their kafala system, that it's never possible to acquire citizenship. But that's a bit of a different story here. How many more minutes do you have?
But you have to keep close to the micros.
Oh, close to the micro. So the low-skilled category is a tricky one. And actually, in my chapter, I don't look at these explicit labor migration programs for low-skilled people. That's a bit of a tedious stuff. I look at family unification. Family unification as... it is, of course, family unification is not low-skilled explicitly, but the presumption behind trying to restrict family migration is that you have people coming in under this premise, under these premises, which are ill-fit for post-industrial economy. And all the restrictions in family unification, in Europe in particular, are out of this sense that family unified people, because of network structures actually in Europe, if you have low-skilled guest workers, then the chances are the family that is brought in is likewise low-skilled. So here, the low-skilled is not the explicit policy label, the explicit name for the policy. It is the empirical assumption that people who come in under the family unification umbrella are low-skilled, and therefore we don't need too many of them. And I think the same mindset is behind the restrictions of asylum migration. Also here, the assumption is mostly these people are ill-fit to survive on their own in a post-industrial service economy. So fending off the bottom, trying to restrict unwanted migration. That is one type of immigration policy. And another type of immigration policy is soliciting the top. That is, to me, that is the structure. That is the structure of immigration policies in the plural in the neoliberal age. And I say neoliberal here with a purpose. And that is now a critique, a little bit a critique. It's also in these little commentaries on the so-called liberal paradox, because the liberal paradox works like a binary. There's openness because liberal states philosophically are committed to trade. They are philosophically committed to defend rights of migrants. And then there's closure. It's already not so clear in the liberal paradox, because the name is just liberal, where this closure is coming from. It reminded me of a famous paradox of a previous constitutional justice of the German Bundesverfassungsgericht, Böckenförde. The Böckenförde diction was, he wrote a remarkable little piece about the presuppositions of liberal democracy that cannot themselves be produced by the very operation of liberal democratic principles. And he pointed his finger at Christianity, something like Christianity is needed, a kind of a preset, a consensus that makes it possible that contracts are kept. This is, of course, a figure you find in Durkheim and the non-contractual elements of the contract. What Jim brings in here is kind of an unspoken nationalism, but that is not itself coming out of the liberal tradition. Anyway, there's a binary. And the binary is not sufficient to get hold at the structure of immigration policies in the neoliberal age. Because at a minimum, we keep the nationalism factor. I actually call it neo-nationalism. But the liberal concept has to be divided in two. I think that's very essential, because one type of liberalism is the rights-protecting, Rawlsian kind of liberalism, which we associate, which I, if I call myself a liberal, and I would do that, then this is in the Rawlsian sense, rights-protecting liberalism. But then there's neoliberalism. That is a bastard. That is the enemy. And that needs to be, you need to put your finger on the enemy here. And I do think, when I started this exercise, rethinking immigration policy and also citizenship policy in my current book, it's not yet done, which is also an auto-criticism, because I, when I entered this domain, thought, yeah, liberalism, that is the story here, right? Immigration policies that move from selecting by origin to selecting by merit, citizenship policies that are more liberal, more inclusive, more universalistic, etc. Now, that is just not sufficient to get hold at a complex structure. Now, here only looking at immigration policies in the plural. Now, when I thought it went into this game, writing this chapter, I thought the fending off the bottom side of immigration policies towards restricting low-skilled migration, family migration, and asylum migration, I thought one could look at it in terms of nationalism or neo-nationalism. And it's true that populist parties, particularly in Europe, they're not so much upset about high-skilled migration. There's very little opposition to it. In an old party program of the Alternative for Germany, for example, they celebrate the Canadian model. It's no longer in the brownish follow-up 2017 program of the Alternative for Germany. And of course, in all of these party programs, they also, of course, really love the Australian model, and that is this prisoner island model for the asylum seekers. So the point I'm trying to make is, even the nasty, control-minded, part of the immigration function can be fully explained, fully described in neoliberal terms. Because why don't you like family migrants? Why don't you like asylum seekers? Because they become a burden of the welfare state. Because these people do not contribute. In Denmark, the main logo of the People's Party, of the Populist Party, is not, we are Christian, we don't want Muslims. No, their main line is, these guys who come under the asylum provisions, they become immediately clients of the welfare state. And we, the taxpayers, the collectivity of the thrifty, we have to pay for these assholes. You see, that is neoliberal reasoning. Therefore, I started my little book with neo-nationalism in the title. No, I already relativized it, the neo-nationalism, neoliberalism nexus. Neoliberalism, to me, is the decisive game in town. And what all these radical right parties do is very little. They add extremely little to the structure of immigration policies in that dualism of soliciting the top and fending off the bottom. They make a little bit more drama in the restrictive bottom, fending off the bottom business, but they don't change the structure. So the liberal paradox is not complex enough to get to this to this point that the enemy is neoliberalism. And I shut off now.
Okay. Thank you, Christian. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jim, for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to show my institute in Amsterdam. And thank you, Christian, for very interesting comments as well. They overlap to some extent, but not fully, happily enough, although then we would have had more time for discussion. I'm a historian, as some of you may know, and I, having read the introduction, again, because a long time ago I read it, but now to read it again, I pose myself the simple question, is there a control gap? And if yes, by which factors was it caused? And how has it changed over time? Because as a historian, I'm interested in changes over time. Mm-hmm. That's, let's say, what we do. And in my brief reflections, I will be looking at specifically at Western and Northern Europe, in the post-war period, as a phase in a much longer durée, you could say that three major shifts have taken place after World War II that, to a certain extent, limited control, although this was not necessarily perceived as a bad thing, by the way. So what are these three? And Christian already mentioned some of them. Well, one, of course, as we all know, is the humanitarian turn. Stephen Jensen's book, The Making of International Human Rights, for example, from 2016, deals with that. Of course, the Refugee Convention of 1951 and its global extension of 1967 that provided a, you could say, a new political opportunity structure. So this is, let's say, the kind of, if you look at the numbers of refugees, and this excludes the German Aussiedler and also, of course, colonial refugees, this is what you get. So yes, there is a new opportunity structure, but it's activated quite late, you could say. It's during the 1950s and 60s because of the Iron Curtain and because of the world being smaller than it is now, so that the effects of this new opportunity structure only become visible in the mid-1980s. Again, it's largely caused by the Yugoslavian Civil War, the falling of the wall, and of course also by European interventions in neighboring regions like the Middle East, Afghanistan, and the Horn of Africa. And if you take it more globally, you could also include Vietnam when it comes to the US, and so more examples. So that would be, let's say, one thing that changed the rules of the game when it comes to controlling migration, because there has been an extra gate through which people can at least ask to be permitted entrance in liberal countries. Well, the second one is, of course, decolonization. I could have added, but this is only for Europe, but Japan clearly also belongs in this when it comes to people returning to Japan from its empire after 1945. So there was a period of people coming back from the empire to the mother or father country. And this, I also have included Germany when it comes to the Aussiedler. And of course, there's no formal empire of Germany, but I think they very well fit in this framework as well. It's interesting, by the way, that authorities at the time, so especially in the 1950s and 1960s, at least up front, not always presented this as a control gap. And front stage often framed them as returnees, like in the Netherlands of Willem Maas's chapter also talks about that briefly. So people coming back from Indonesia, for example, 350,000. Well, most of them never been in the Netherlands. I mean, they were of mixed descent, Eurasians, but the authorities very deliberately front stage said, these are Dutch. In order to create, let's say, tolerance for this unwanted immigration, because the Netherlands wanted to get rid of people at the same time. They were having a very active emigration policy and were convinced that the country was overpopulated. But again, front stage, they saw the message, these are Dutch and we all have to take care of them because they are nationals. Backstage, by the way, they told their officials, keep this group as small as possible because we don't want all these brown people from Indonesia. But this was not communicated to the public. You could say that in the neo-nationalist frame, we do exactly the other way around. So we have this very neo-nationalist frame that we don't want these people, while if you look at practice, you see that many more people are admitted than this discourse would make you think. So that's decolonization as a second force that changed the game, and sometimes this refugee and post-colonial overlap, and that's in the case of Germany very clear, where you see that in the 1990s huge numbers of refugees, and not only from Yugoslavia but also from the Middle East, came to Germany and other countries as well. But on top of that, there was this very large and sometimes large of inflow of Soviet citizens who could claim some sort of German heritage, sometimes going back to the 18th century. And this was also in a period, as you can see by the line, where employment was increasing. And this is also a sobering kind of a comparison, let's say, when you think of these very alarmistic and apocalyptical visions of, let's say, the refugee crisis in 2015. So here you see that these two new opportunity structures then coincide in the case of Germany. Well, the third, a development or factor that changed the game is the welfare state. And Jim has written about that already in his 1992 book, where you see all kind of, and I'll explain this in a moment, the unintended effects of building social and residency rights by labor migrants, especially the so-called guest workers, and let's say their permanent residence was ironically activated only when, let's say, the countries like the Netherlands, Germany, France, Belgium, when they decided very openly to give the message that the borders would be closing. So many people, instead of leaving, they stayed and made use of the right of family reunification, because they realized if they would go, they would never be allowed back in. So here you see this inverted relationship between immigration from Morocco, and the same is, this is for the Netherlands, but this very, very similar, these are flow figures, by the way, and then the unemployment among this group in blacks, with the on the right hand side the percentage of unemployment, and there you see that where normally, let's say, when the labor market would regulate migration, you would not expect this, that people would keep on coming, while unemployment among this group is towering. And so at the end of the 1980s, more than half of the people with Moroccan background were unemployed. But to explain this, so there's a very unintended effect of, let's say, the welfare state. So these are the three major things that change, let's say, how states to what extent states could control migration. And I think it would be interesting to historicize in that sense the introduction maybe a little bit more. And this is only about Europe, of course, this is a global book, so you have to think about other regions as well and how it works. So then the preliminary conclusions would be that, yes, so we see a change to a more rights-based migration regime, if you use the terms used in the introduction. Yet this change, as I argue in my comments, may just have been an interlude, because decolonization was a one-off thing. I mean, there's no colonial migrants will come anymore. Welfare states have largely been made migration-proof. Hey? You have to function has also largely vanished. Also, when it comes to intra-European migration, for example, so people really have to earn themselves into the system much more than the guest workers had to. And well, when we see the whole outsourcing of the borders of the EU far into Africa, the role of Turkey, the role of I was reading this stuff about people in Idlib now last week, 300,000 on the run for Assad. They cannot even enter Turkey because there's a big gate between Turkey and Syria, partly paid by the EU, by the way. So you see that a lot of these, all three, let's say at least two of the factors have been are more or less gone, and the third one is under threat. Yes, I think there may be an increase in conversion in migration regime, at least within Europe, but with very contradictory effects. So it's increasing the freedom of migration within the EU, and that's also the thing that François showed. It's reflected in these figures, the free migration category in that. I think there's a very well-controlled labor migration from third country nationals through the visa regime. And there are increasing barriers for low-skilled and refugee migration from outside the EU. So in terms of Jim's migration state model, we could see a shift from a more normative rights-based migration regime to a more culturalized security regime, but with the economic drivers remaining quite stable. So you could say we are moving into a much more labor market dominated regime, regulated by this external visa regime that came up in the 1990s and backed up by an internal EU free migration. So yes, Christian is right, we are to a large, we are rolling out the red carpet, and I think that's well put. And one very important mainstream Dutch politician a month ago said, we need 50,000 Polish labor migrants a year. I mean, at the same time where people are, let's say, being very apocalyptic about refugees and asylum seekers. So, and that's also one of my reflections on the introduction, that it's not always clear who are we talking about when it comes to migration. Mm-hmm. Are we talking about wanted, unwanted migration? So what's mm-hmm. the basic category? And that, I think, makes a big difference when it comes to whether we talk about gaps or mm-hmm. not. Mm-hmm. But François had already much better. I wish I would have had his graph. But just to show, let's say, how much labor market driven these migration to the Netherlands, for example. There's total immigration, and you see, and I've just separately put, let's say, the share of asylum seekers, which is decreasing, as we all know, since 2015. So the bulk are labor migrants from Europe. Part of the asylum seekers are in the Asian and African column in 2018, it's very much the same picture that François already showed. So finally, to understand these changes over time and why we have started thinking about gaps in the first place, I think it's also important to realize that apart from these this development, we have to realize the existence of what I would call a optimist-pessimist business cycle when it comes to how we think about migration and integration, and with all kind of national variations. But I think for Western Europe as a whole, and I think, and this is or maybe the North Atlantic as a whole, it is important to realize that from the 1960s to 1980s, due to an ethical revolution, and this is part of this humanitarian turn, the realization of the Holocaust, and this led to a rather open attitude and a stress on non-discrimination, on equality. Saskia Bonjour also wrote a very good piece in the International Migration Review in 2011 about that. And this was a, let's say, an optimistic a kind of phase. And this only lost steam with the recession of the 1980s, the very unlucky timing of the family reunification, and then on top of that, the Rushdie affair in 1998 and 1989, which really signaled the beginning of a much more pessimistic kind of turn, with a kind of clash of civilizations framework then starting to dominate. So, and there's, by the way, an interesting way how that idea from North America ended up and was, let's say, appropriated by European politicians. And I don't think, so it's all no coincidence that we started thinking about gaps in the 1990s. I think, mm-hmm. So it's a kind of a meta a question, why did you start thinking about gaps? So I think there's a has to be historicized as well. So which also means that we should pay more attention to the role of discourse in the, what Christian noemed, the neo-nationalist kind of discourse, in the migration state, which often is very much, and Francois has also pointed at that, very independent from what is actually happening. Hey, the Africans are coming, well, but this is highly influencing officials and bureaucrats in this migration state. And that's one other point that in reading your introduction, I think you should make much more clear that these people, I'm not sure whether you imply this, but it's not entirely clear whether these officials, they are not neutrals. They are not just technocrats who think, oh, we have different interests and how to juggle them. No, they're part of this process themselves as well. Well, just to give you, but again, this is nothing new, when it comes to, let's say, numbers, these are the number and origins of asylum seekers in the EU. So in the 2015, and of course it goes down after this, I did not have the time to include the numbers for the last 3 years. So this whole apocalyptical thinking around 2015, if you compare it with what's happening in the 1990s, and again, then these were not all Yugoslavians, and now we have these stupid Muslims around 2015. Also then it was largely the Horn of Africa and the Middle East and Afghanistan dominating the flows. This already, let's say, shows how much this apocalyptical discourse has taken over. And this is a factor I think you should maybe pay some more attention to. And the same is true for, let's say, people coming from Africa. Well, most of them come with visa, as we all know. But those who don't and who apply for asylum, here you see this is, let's say, 30 years. There's no real increase into crazy numbers. I mean, this is all between 100 and 150,000 a year, which is 0.01% of the total population of sub-Saharan Africa. So, I mean, this whole idea of Africa emptying out, I saw you were citing Collier, I would be prudent with that, is really nonsense. So, yeah, I'll leave it at this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.